Hi, I'm Louise Goodman, and you're listening to the fantastic Cut to the Race podcast.
It's lights out and away we go!
Is that Goff? Is that Goff going slowly?
It is!
That's Goff! Oh my goodness me!
Oh God! Michael Schumacher hits David Coulthard and he's out! He's third! Jenson Button wins!
And I've got to stop because I'm going to love the black road.
Hello and welcome to the Cut to the Race podcast. We're recording on a Thursday, which is a bit unusual, but it is the Easter weekend. On the show today with us, we have Dan, our writer, Emma, also a writer, Callum, who sorts out our social media stuff, and we've got someone so much more interesting than them on the show. I'm having a bit of a fanboy moment, I'm not going to lie, but we have Louise Goodman. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Please don't fanboy me. It's very sweet of you.
I think a lot of people like me who grew up in sort of my generation following motorsport will have heard you every weekend on the TV. And for those that don't know who you are, Louise, what would you say you are in one sentence?
I would say I am a motorsport reporter and TV presenter who also runs her own media and presentation skills training company.
Amazing. Well,
weren't
I might
the last bit, weren't you?
No, well, I was actually, but I was also thinking I might need a few tips after this. So, we'll keep in contact. So, Louise, tell me, how did you get involved in motorsport in the first place? Because it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were the first F1 female presenter. Was it always a passion of yours, or did you sort of stumble into it?
No, I'd stumbled into it. You're right in the latter case. It came about because I met a guy called Tony Jardine. I was actually working in powerboat racing. So I was working in journalism on a small publishing company. And I was on a powerboat racing magazine. And I met Tony when he was handling the PR for the Virgin Atlantic Challenge, which was a great big powerboat that did the Blue Ribbon Crossing many years ago. And then I kind of met him again at a mutual friend's barbecue, and I just overheard him saying to somebody that he was setting up his own PR company. So Tony Jardine, for those people who don't know, has been involved in motorsport for many, many years. I think he started off as a tyre fitter for Goodyear back in the day, but has been involved heavily on the PR side, running his own company. And he'd worked for a company called CSS Promotions, was just setting up his own company and was looking for somebody to go and work with him. I was going traveling, so I was looking for an easier job than editing the magazine. So when I heard him say he was looking for somebody, we kind of had a quick chat, and so that was it. So I went to work for Tony, and so he was my entree really into the world of motor racing, because that was an area that he'd been working in for quite some time. So the first job we had was launching Camel when they came into Formula One, sponsoring the Lotus Formula One team with Senna and Nakajima. So that was really my entree into the world of motorsport. And I came in at the top at the Formula One level, which, you know, kind of pisses people off, I'd imagine, who've been grafting away in junior formulae. And I'd never been to somewhere like Alton Park or Croft, and, you know, until recent years. So that was really how it came about. I'd never set out to work in motorsport. I like cars. I grew up in a town in Hampshire called Alsford, which is where Derek Warwick and his family live. So I used to walk past Warwick trailers on my way to school, and Derek was stock car racing at the time. So I knew that was where the racing driver, you know, that was the family business, because he was in the local paper. But never, never, ever did it cross my mind that I was, you know, going to work in motorsport and in Formula One for the past God knows how many decades. So it was a set of happy circumstance, really.
I'm assuming you've met and interviewed and spoken with many people over the years you've been doing it. Who is the standout person that you have interviewed during your career? Like, was there a certain moment with a certain person that will always stay with you forever, and you'll just forever look back on that as that was the pinnacle of my career?
George Clooney? That's high up there. That's probably, you're probably thinking of racing.
not the answer I expected, but
that was the one that loads of people commented on the time. That was at the Monaco Grand Prix. In fact, I got George Clooney, Brad Pitt and Matt Damon all at the same time. They were down there promoting Ocean's 10, 11, 12, whatever it was at the time. Wow. So but I suppose in motor racing, it's difficult to pick out one interview. There are several ones that will always stick in my mind. So I remember one of my very, very first, when I first went, so I was a press officer for 5 or 6 years and then got into the TV side of things. Again, that was just being approached by ITV, who were looking for a female reporter to be on the team. And they kind of wanted somebody who knew about motorsports. So they said, was I interested? So I had no TV experience, no broadcasting experience. I'd never trained in broadcasting, anything like that. They kind of gave me a microphone and said, off you go. And one of my early draws interviews, Melbourne, which was our first Grand Prix, I can remember interviewing Eddie Irvine, who I'd worked with. I'd been his press officer when we were at both at Jordan Grand Prix. And it was an interview on the grid. And he was kind of sitting down on the sort of grass verge on the edge of the grid with his back up against the wall. And I knew, because I knew Eddie, if I asked him to stand up, he'd tell me to get stuff. So I just sat down beside him because it was just the easier way to go about it rather than having to have an argument with him. And afterwards, Neil Duncanson, who was the heading up the ITV coverage, he said, that was exactly what we wanted, a different style, a different way of going about things. I didn't have the heart to tell him. It was only because, you know, I knew I'd get told to get stuffed if I'd asked Eddie to stand up. But so that's a standout interview because it was my first and, you know, one of my very first, and it went really well. Another one that always I remember is the first interview with Eddie Jordan when Jordan won their first Grand Prix in Spa, which was something, having been his press officer, I'd said to him, you win your first Grand Prix, I want the first bloody interview. So it was elbows out and battled my way through. But EJ, bless him, he was like, no, I'm talking to her. So that one, for personal reasons, I just loved, you know, because it was fulfilling a promise, something that both of us wanted to do. And then probably one of my biggest interviews, one of my final interviews with ITV during the F1 days was the interview with Lewis when he won his first world championship. So all the drama of that Grand Prix. And then, of course, after the race, it absolutely pissed down with rain. So, and the post-race interviews were somewhat more chaotic then than they are now. So, and because Lewis wasn't on the podium and we were only guaranteed getting the top three drivers, the podium interviews back then, we had to kind of run around and grab other people. So there was no mechanism in place for bringing the man of the moment, Lewis Hamilton, to the media. So it was all a bit of a bun fight. And as I say, it was pissing down with rain. And that was a proper elbows out moment because I was just... So, and if you look at the footage of that now... You know, my earphones are half off and I'm absolutely drenched and like the camera shot is going everywhere because it was such a bun fight. But obviously, as a sign off for ITV, that was our final race covering Formula One. That was a big moment. So that, you know, that was a big interview for me to get as well. So I guess those are some that really sort of stand out for me.
I was going to say, if I had to pick one moment of Louise Goodman over the years, it would have been that 2008 moment where it was just chaos. I mean, you were there when... Really, that was a moment in history for F1 that people will remember forever. What's it like getting to be in that moment? Because not many people get to experience that.
It's a bit of a... Because that moment that you're viewing back at home, I'm responsible for bringing it to you. Mm-hmm. So it's quite pressurised because... Everybody wanted to talk to Lewis and I needed to make sure that, you know, he's a British, there's a sort of unwritten rule, the way that it worked then. As I say, obviously it's different now because the drivers, everybody, it's very clearly delineated in the pen that you'll see and the press officers bring the drivers to you and they, but back then it was a bit more everybody, you know, every man or woman for themselves here. So I really did have to, everybody wanted that story. That was the story of the race. And I had to make sure that our viewers got it, that they got that interview. So I was kind of stuck to the back of Lewis as his press officer kind of took him through that crowd, which is why I look so disheveled, because of course the media had all made way for Lewis to come through. I'd stuck to his back and then they kind of closed back in. So my cameraman was kind of trapped behind. But so it's panic would be too strong, but you know, the pressure was really on me to get that first interview with him. So yeah, it's times like that, you know, what you're seeing as a viewer is very, in some ways, different to what I'm experiencing. You're wrapped up in the moment and the joy of Lewis winning his first championship. I'm slightly cacking myself that somebody else might get in there before I get this interview. So, because that's my priority.
You've mentioned previously that you worked with Jordan Formula One team. How does that differ from working for the external media on an average race weekend or over the year as a whole?
Well, as a press officer, I was the poacher. Sorry, I was the gamekeeper. I was the one trying to, you know, manage the interaction with the journalist. As now I'm on the other side of the fence, I'm the poacher. I'm the one who's trying to get in there and nick and get what I can. So it's kind of two sides of the same sphere, but you're coming at it from very different directions. So, and I have to say, you know, I was working as a press officer in the days pre-social media, pre-internet connection, quite frankly, you know, so it was a different, it was a very different job then. We live in a 24-hour media age now. Back then, you know, the journalists filed their copy over the phone back to Fleet Street. The photographers were all by the swimming pool by 3 o'clock in the afternoon once, you know, qualifying had finished, because they got all the pictures. They couldn't do anything with them other than shove them in their bag, ready to take on the plane back with them on Sunday night. So it was a different media age, that's for sure.
Working at Jordan, you must have worked very closely with Eddie Jordan himself. And I know that he's quite a lively character. I think he's as mad as a box of frogs as Eddie.
You're right.
He's really opinionated, which is something that I absolutely love about him. But what was it like working with him? What sort of things did you learn from Eddie?
he was brilliant fun to work with. And he's still a mate now. You know, we still have a load of banter. Eddie, one of Eddie's many phrases is, "Oi, fucking made you, oi, fucking own you." And so we'll have that banter going back. It was, "Oi, fucking made you a fucking megastar, EJ. Oi, fucking made you." That's what the fucking television use the language, but there's always a fucking involved there with EJ. So, you know, he was brilliant fun to work for, because myself and Ian Phillips, who was the commercial director, we used to joke, does anybody, Eddie's two favourite things, and this is what we used to say, he likes being rich and he likes being famous. So we used to say, okay, who's going to have a busy day? Does he want to be rich today or does he want to be famous today? So, but the fact that he loves the media side of things, he loves the spotlight, he was actually quite easy to deal with. And every now and then he'd throw this like, "Oh, I'm not fucking talking to them, I'm too fucking busy." And you just had to say, "All right, no problem, Eddie. I've told the journalist you won't talk to him." What? No, fucking tell him to come back or talk to him. So he was very amenable. So as a press officer, having somebody like EJ to deal with, he was very happy to talk to the media the whole time. And yeah, he quotes fall out of his mouth, don't they? He's he's great to work with on that side. He's a great character. You know, every sport needs characters. And half the time, you know, sometimes Eddie talks absolute bullshit, but he talks it in such an engaging, entertaining way. And then, to be fair to Eddie, you know, sometimes he comes out with absolute blinders, you know, fantastic little insider bits of information. So, yeah, it's never a dull moment. It was a rock and roll F1 lifestyle. It was fabulous. Loved it.
I think we're going to need to get Eddie on this podcast, because you're right. He's not censored like everyone else in the paddock. He just says what he thinks. And I think that's becoming a rare thing. But enough about Eddie. So working within within an F1 team before you became obviously a part of the media, did that give you a bit of an advantage of you knew how to approach people? You knew the inner workings?
Well, that's the only reason I was employed. You know, I knew nothing about broadcasting. No, I mean, but it's quite true. You know, the consortium, it's MAC1 it was called, so it was Meridian, Anglia and Chrysalis TV. There were various different production companies that were bidding to get the contract with ITV to make the programmes. And it was MAC1, Meridian, Anglia and Chrysalis, this little consortium that approached me and said, "Are you interested in being on our bid?" Because they knew about making television programmes. They needed people who knew about the paddock and knew what to ask, who to ask it of, and when to ask it as well, because that's an important thing. If you want to get information from people, you need to be able to read a garage, understand the nuances of what's going on, know the right people to ask and the right questions to ask them in order to sort of get that respect and build up that working relationship with people. So, yeah, trust me, they didn't employ me for my broadcast. It'd never go back. Bradley Lord, who's now the head of communications at Mercedes, every now and then he pisses me off by reminding me that he watched my first interviews from, and I can remember, you know, just, it was just a high voice and a high squeaky voice, because I was so frightened. Literally, they gave me a microphone and said, off you go. James Allen was great. He kind of gave me a few pointers about, you know, ask a question this way rather than that way. But I the rest of it, I kind of made up as I went along. So it was quite daunting. And, you know, at times back then, just because there were less channels, so a lot, but we'd have millions and millions of people tuning in, 5, 6, 7 million, you know, that's a lot of people to listen to you learning how to do a job, really, isn't it? So I tried to block that out of my mind as much as possible. But I mean, yeah, at times, you know, I was incredibly nervous. And when you're incredibly nervous, that comes out in your voice. But yeah, as I say, they employed me because I knew the people. I knew my topic as well. That's an important thing. If you're going to have respect, no matter what it is you're interviewing on, you need to ask a sensible question in order to get a sensible answer. So
have you ever been floating around the paddock and someone's just sort of come out of a garage up to you and sort of said, do you fancy having a go in this? And they've let you sort of jump in the car and just unleash yourself around a lot. Like, have you ever been able to do that?
Funnily enough, not many Formula One teams want you to have a go in there.
I don't necessarily mean in the actual F1 car. I mean,
why?
You know, maybe Bert Mylander approached you and said, jump in the safety car. I don't know.
Oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to get my hands on the new Aston that they've got now as well. Yeah. But I mean, I'd have happily had a go in the Merc. I mean, that for me was the sexiest car out there for the last few years, since they, you know, since the Formula One cars don't sound quite so exciting. No, I mean, I the minute I was on television, I did get people saying, do you want to? So I got to do some rallying, which was fantastic. You know, I was approached and asked if I wanted to take part in the Ford Car Championship. But they wouldn't have asked me that if I was still a press officer at Jordan, that's for sure. So, you know, I was in not only the first ever race for two-seater Formula One cars, but the first ever crash for two-seater Formula One cars. So when Paul Stoddart built his two-seaters, he had a little race up at Donington. And I was in the back of Alonso's car. So I got to experience that. And in fact, I probably would have been Renault at a French Grand Prix one year. They'd got some old F1 cars, albeit rather detuned F1 cars that they, you know, I'm a bit of a sucker for these things. So I'll stick my hand up and go, yeah. And it's only afterwards I think, oh, shit, I don't know what I'm doing. But so, yeah, I have been lucky enough to have a few experiences like that. I mean, in the Formula One car, well, I say annoyingly, probably very sensibly, they stuck a pace car out in front of us. So I was trying, first off, don't bloody stall the thing when you leave the pits and look like a total idiot. And then I was just trying to lag back a bit so I could actually floor it and get some sense of the, I say floor it, I wasn't going to floor it, I was scared the bejesus out of myself, but just to get some kind of feeling of the power of it. So yeah, no team has ever said, oh, do you want to come in and drive this? But I have been lucky enough to, because of the position that I'd been in and the job that I do, to get some driving experiences that maybe wouldn't have come so easily to other people, that's for sure. Perks of the job. Nobody's offered, said, do you fancy driving our touring car yet? But I live in hope.
So you've had, you know, you've been in F1 for many years and you've done some commentary in your time as well. Do you have a best moment, but also a toughest moment that you've commentated on?
Tough moments.
Sounds like we may have already covered the tough moment with Lewis.
There have been, I think tough moments tend to revolve around tough circumstances. So difficult circumstances rather than tough circumstances. So it kind of revolves around accidents and incidents. I mean, the one that instantly springs to mind is not in F1, but in the British Touring Car Championship. You know, we were live on air when Billy Munger had his accident. And it's a very delicate line that you have to walk there. Part of my job is to obviously tell people, inform people what's going on. So there's several strands. At something like a touring car race, I've got to inform my director what's happening, because the race is delayed, we need to kind of have a plan for what's happening and when it's happening so that we can, because we've still got a television program to put on. So do we show a race from earlier? Do we just fill for 10 minutes? So there's that all going on. But also I've got to find out the medical information and get information. It very much comes down to knowing who to ask and having a relationship with people. So Paul Trafford, who's the sort of chief medical officer at the touring car races, you know, Traff knows me well enough to know that he can trust me with information. So there's that. But then also you have to be very careful. You know, the people's friends and families are watching this. So you need to make sure that the information that you're giving out is not personal information that they wouldn't want shared, and it's done in a sensitive and respectful manner. So that's not one interview per se, but that's an idea of the scenario when it's most difficult to, and also most important to get it right. Most interviews, you know, if you screw up a bit, if you ask a dumb question, sometimes the wrong thing comes out of your mouth. You know. Is it the end of the world? No, it's not at all. But in a very in a tricky situation like that, it's really important. What a driver says when he's run away, saw had a crash, you know, or just spun off or whatever, and there's no injury. You know, it's not the end of the world in any way, shape, or form. So I think those are the most challenging, not so much interviews, but media situations to be in.
I think, yeah, just if looking at a recent example as well, with Grosjean's crash in Bahrain last year, as a person sat there watching it, I was really dialed into what the commentators were saying at that point because of how shocked I was that it had just happened. So everything you said needed to be so precise and accurate. Is there the pressure there must have been quite high?
Absolutely. I mean, thank God Grosjean was out of that car so quickly. That story, you know, so it was like... It was almost, you could do it all on one intake of breath, but you could let your breath out reasonably quickly because thank God he was okay. But yeah, it is tricky. And, you know, all of us there, we're human. We're there working, but we're also having the same human response as you are having sitting at home watching this awful drama unfolding on the television. So, but you've got to make sure, you know, that you don't let your personal feelings get in the way of your professional role that you're undertaking at that time.
Mm. And I think the other one that reminds me of this is Murray Walker, when obviously it was in Imola, and exactly the same scenario, and how that just shows a level of professionalism to handle that scenario when you have an idea what might be going on, but you're trying to get through it. And I take my hat off to anyone that can do that. I was a mess watching Grosjean. I was an absolute mess. I thought, you know, thought what everyone thought. I couldn't have kept my words together, that's for sure.
No, I couldn't be a commentator. Mm. You know, the role that I do as a reporter, I could not just talk like they talk. And they, you know, I don't have to speak in the moment. When that's happening, I go off and find the information and you know, when I'm ready and I've got the information, I've got something to say. I'm not just having to talk over a scenario when you don't really know what's happening. It's a tricky, tricky role.
So speaking of interviews, I've got with me here a little motorsport time machine. If you could go back to any era of any discipline in motorsport, where would you go and who would you talk to?
I would go back to the 70s. Because that's the era that I first remember. I'm dating myself here, aren't I? But, you know, what first sparked my interest in motorsport was the likes of James Hunt, who was just, and Barry Sheen, you know, they were both around at the same time. They were massive characters, totally un-PC when you look at the stuff they got up to, you know, and judge it based on how we think about these things now. But it was... You know, and James was a. I mean, obviously, I got to meet him later on when I was actually working in the paddock. But he was just this sexy, fun bloke who turned up on the Morecambe and Wise show and other programs that you guys will never have heard of because you're far too young. You know, he was all across the television then. So, and he just had that floppy-haired, barefoot, you know, chain smoking naughtiness about him that even as a young kid I thought, well, I like the look of that. It's more about me than it does about him, really, doesn't it? But yeah, so you know, that's my kind of standout era. That's when I first remember watching cars racing at Monaco and that kind of thing. So that's probably And all the naughtiness that went on then. I mean, you know, there's still naughtiness that goes on now, but it's, you can't be as naughty as even was I was, you know, when I was first working in Formula One. You know, it was de rigueur to do two laps of the circuit in the hire car on the way back to the airport on a Sunday night. You know, health and safety, there's no way you could get away with that kind of shit now. And memories of parties and, you know, racing drivers so drunk they were falling backwards out of windows. And again, that, you know, I'm sure racing drivers get drunk, but not in that public domain anymore, because everybody's got a phone, everybody's got a camera, you know, so everybody has to be so careful these days. They don't have the time as well like we used to, because it is a 24-hour, you know, data age that we live in. Whether you're working on the technical side of the sport, on the media side of the sport, people are at it 24 hours a day. So listen, I'm sure there are still people having fun in the paddock. I just don't think they have much fun as I did in my early days of Formula One, and we didn't probably have as much fun as there was going on back in the 70s. So that's when I'd like to go back to.
So do you think that almost, it's lost the essence of what F1 was? Because I totally agree with you. You know, certain drivers, they can't walk out of a hotel room without paparazzi everywhere. But back in that era, they could just be who they were. Do you think that's taken a bit of the fun away?
I think we live in a different era. I think it's difficult to compare. You know, the sport is a lot more professional, and that has its downsides, but people don't get killed and seriously injured like they used to, you know, so there's a flip side to everything. It's there's no better, there's no worse. It's a lot more professional, you know, people, it's a lot more secure as a job. It's a lot more, you know, so you can't knock it for what it is now. And, you know, trust me, racing drivers still manage to have some fun. It's just not party central, which it would have been, you know. Back then, racing drivers would be up on the lash the night before with, you know, a woman on each arm and one spare, and, you know, get in the car with a hangover. And, you know, it was incredibly unprofessional if you think about it in that respect. But, you know, there's no better, there's no worse. It's just different.
I'm going to join you in that motorsport time machine, I think.
It seems as like it's kind of much more controlled fun now than what it used to be back then.
Yeah, I think it is because everybody, they don't have time, as much time on their hands as we had. And as it's, you know, health and safety, there's no way you could go hooning around the circuit in a minibus now. It used to scare the shit out of me when, you know, one of the mechanics or the chief mechanic, who was a bit of a hooligan at the time, would often drive around, and I'd be just thinking, just get the wheels back on the ground. This is not my idea of a good time. But
going down to track in a minibus, I have done that at the Las Vegas Speedway, and it is one of the scariest things I've ever done.
It's really scary, isn't it? With some bloke who thinks he's a racing driver but isn't.
Yeah.
I could
see the ground. I was like, oh my God. I'm looking out the window going, there's tarmac right there, like next to my face.
Professional behind the wheel, fine. Some wannabe who's just showing off. No, yeah. It's not my idea of a good time.
You're also an ambassador for the whole Dare to Be Different initiative, which is now joined forces with the Girls on Track.
Girls on Track UK, yep.
Now, I am part of that community, and I actually met you at Silverstone when it first launched. And I was at the time a new mum, and I had an F1 blog, and I was in two minds as to what exactly to do with this blog, because I was thinking, I'm a new mum, am I going to have time for this? Do I want to get into motorsport as a career? But I actually spoke to you about it, and you gave me some really, really great advice, which...
Thank God for that. I spoke to you about it, and you were really useless.
And she quit.
She said, I'm really busy. Come back later.
Because just at the time, I was just thinking, should I continue doing this blog? I had so much more responsibility at home with a new baby, and that was like 5 years ago now. But how has your involvement with this helped inspire a lot more women to get into motorsport?
It's something that when I was first working in motorsport, there were a lot less girls in the paddock than there are. There were a lot less people in the paddock than there are now, full stop. So, but certainly, you know, you could probably count on the fingers of two hands and maybe one foot, the amount of girls that there were altogether in the Formula One paddock. And I was very conscious of not wanting to stand out, one of the boys, I don't, you know what I mean? It's like, can I carry your bag? No, I carry my own bag. I didn't need, you know what I mean? So I wanted to fit in and I wanted to be one of the boys and I didn't want anybody treating me any different just because I was a girl and I wanted to kind of just keep my head down and get on with the job. I've now become very aware, and it's partly because of people saying to me, oh my God, I remember watching you or listening to you on the television and thinking, oh my goodness, I could work in motorsport. You know, I've become aware of the importance of visibility. And this is why Susie, who set up Dare to Be Different initially, you know, that was her raison d'etre. It's the whole you need to see it to be it kind of thing. So you need to have visibility. You need to have role models. You know, the reason so many little 9-year-old boys get to karting, they want to be Lewis Hamilton. They want to be Kimi Räikkönen, not Kimi Räikkönen. Do you know what I mean? You know, whoever it may be. Little girls who get into karting, who do they want? Well, there aren't any Formula One drivers. So you need to have people visibly there to encourage the sort of next generation to get into things. So I think it's really important, and I'm quite passionate about, I get a bit pissed off when people sort of say, oh, Formula One is sexist, because I actually genuinely don't think that motorsport per se, they just want the best people for the job. The fact of the matter is that the majority of the fish swimming in the pond that they're drawing from at the moment, they all look the same. They're all male and they're all white. So we need to get, you know, a wider selection of fish in the pond for them. And again, that's what Dare to Be Different and now Motorsport UK, it's all about. It's about when encouraging young girls to get into STEM subjects, encouraging young girls to get in, you know, to all different areas of motorsport. Some of the things I've come across, I mean, one of the early days, Dare to Be Different, there were various different activities going on, but one of them, Shell had sent along a Ferrari show car and it had some little goggles so you could kind of watch a particle of oil going through the sort of, you know, through the engine and through the whole sort of system. And one of the, I don't know if she was a teacher or just one of the sort of responsible adults that was with the girls that day, said to me, oh, this little girl, she knows quite a lot about this car because her brother and her dad are into Formula One. So I went up and said to this girl, I understand you know a bit about the car. And she said, yes, yeah, this is the whatever Ferrari it was. And the really interesting thing about this car is if you see the way that they've designed this, so the air, it goes around, this is called the side pod, and the air goes around the side pod and it goes down to the back here. And the diffuser on this car, so she basically started explaining to me a blown diffuser. And I said to the teacher, excuse me, with the greatest respect, this little girl is passionate about aerodynamics. And that's exactly what this is about, because you're just assuming she knows about this because her dad and her brother are into it. No, she knows about it because she's into it. We need to be encouraging that. We need to be celebrating and encouraging that. I did a podcast recently and it was all girls. You've got me going on the girls in motorsport topic here. But it was all girls who were working as engineers and one girl who was working as a mechanic. And out of five of them, four of them have been to all girls' schools. Now, I can only draw my conclusion based on obviously a small pool there, is that girls who are going to co-ed schools, it's the people are gravitating towards the boys when it comes to the STEM subjects. Because these girls are at all girls' schools, the teachers have got to find one of the girls to you know, encourage towards the STEM subjects. So I just think it's about having some good positive role models. And if that sometimes means that you've got to be biased towards getting girls or people of ethnic minorities into the sport, then so be it. Sometimes that has to happen.
I remember that it was a podcast we did a while ago. I think it was with Abby Eaton, and she said exactly the same thing. She said, it's not that girls are less talented, it's that there is a smaller number. So the ratio has to increase, otherwise it will never happen. And I know Matt Bishop was very, very, very obviously opinionated on this subject. He would be. But I think role models like yourself, Louise, and Jenny Goh, who we spoke to the other week, it's actually paying off. And I hope that you guys can see all of that, because when we look for writers or whatever, we have the people that you inspire coming to us who want to get involved with F1 because you've given them a voice that they possibly didn't think they had before. And it's, you know, it's thanks to the work that you guys do. So it's nice to see.
That's really kind of you to say, and I do think it's important. It's something that, as I said, in the early days, I was like, oh, don't, you know, and Now, as you just heard, I'm quite happy to get up on my high horse about it. Apologies if I went on a bit long about that one, but it's important.
It is really important. I mean, at the moment, as Ollie said, we're actually looking for more writers, and I put a post up on the FIA, the Girls on Track community.
I had you were inundated, weren't you?
Yeah, I was overwhelmed with messages. I think I had over 100 messages. And I'm trying to get through every single one of them. And I'm going, like, sorry, I will get back to you. But it's amazing the amount of women and girls that want to actually get into motorsport. They're just trying to find an avenue to do so. And with Dare to Be Different, for me, that was the opportunity for me. Because, as I said, I had an F1 blog. I just didn't know what to do with it. And I remember speaking to you and you just said, just break down some doors, keep going, don't give up with it. Because if it's something that you're really, really passionate about, if you just let it go, then you'll regret it. And I took that advice and I thought, do you know what? I'm actually going to do something with it. And here I am, you know, I'm with Formula Nerds and we're doing amazing things, reaching however many people it is the month.
Talking interviews to Louise. Great people.
Yeah, talking to Louise, I know. I'm like, this is like amazing. But what advice would you give to any young girl or woman like myself who is aspiring to get into an F1 paddock or looking to work as a mechanic or an aerodynamicist? What sort of advice would you give them?
I think, to be honest, it wouldn't just be for women. It would be for anybody across the board, probably similar to what I gave to you. You know, knock on doors. It's not just what you know, it's who you know as well. And okay, for depending on the, you know, if you want to work on the engineering side or as a mechanic or whatever, you've got to have the qualifications. I mean, in this day and age, you know, probably if you want to work on the media side, you've got to have the relevant qualifications as well. There was no such thing as a journalism degree or, you know, media studies degree. Back in my day, you kind of learnt on the job. You went to work for a local paper or for a magazine or something like that. So I think you've got to have the knowledge, but it's a competitive business. So you've got to be prepared to go the extra mile. Don't aim too high. It's unlikely that you're going to walk straight into a job in Formula One. You know, if you really want to work in the sport includes club racing, it includes national championships like the British Touring Car Championship. That's where you're going to get your experience and make your contacts and also have your ear to the ground. You know, once you're in there and you're meeting people, if there's a job that comes up somewhere, you know, you're more likely to hear about it. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, people might look at motorsport externally and think, oh, it's so glamorous. Trust me, it's not always bloody glamorous when you're in there. It's long hours. I always describe it, it's not just a job, it's a way of life. So you've got to be prepared to commit to that way of life. You're not there to be a fan, you're there to work. So yes, I think you've got to be passionate about the sport because otherwise, quite frankly, you wouldn't want to give up the time and, you know, miss out on all the parties and the festivals and everything else that goes on over a weekend that you have to say, oh, I'm working that weekend. So you've got to have the passion for it and to give you the drive to get involved. But it's also important to go in there thinking, I'm not here to fangirl or fanboy, I'm here to work. So, because if you're not putting in the hours, I hesitated before using the word fanboy there. But, you know, if you're not prepared to put in the hours, there's going to be somebody else who is.
Absolutely. And I think that's almost what you've said is a representation of who we are, which is we never expected this. We're just passionate people who do it for the fun of it and take the opportunities that you're given. And in your role, you've obviously seen so many drivers come and go. You've seen people at the beginning of their careers through all the way through it. What I want to know is, who did you find a real special, what we call a star? Because there are everyone in who's in this, you know, F1 and the high tiers of motorsport, they're good drivers. But there are a few stars, and you know, you would point out maybe Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton, for example, as the current sort of stars that stand out. But in your career, who have you watched develop into one of those?
I don't think you watch them develop because they're twinkling away before they ever get into Formula One. You know, I can remember hearing about Jenson Button years before he ever came anywhere near Formula One. Same for Lewis Hamilton. You know, I was there at the Autosport Awards when he famously, you know, this tiny little thing walked up on stage with his great big karting trophy. And so you hear about those people before they ever get to Formula One level. And I find, you know, I love the fact now, you know, now that I'm working in national racing as well, so in the British Touring Car Championship, you know, we've got the F4 series on our bill. Well, in fact, before that, you've got Ginetta Juniors, which is where kids at the age of 14 can drive a car. And they can't drive a formula car like F4 till they get to 15. So you find a lot of kids who will look upon Ginetta, which is a fantastic championship. You know, for some of them, it's the start of a career in GTs. For others, it's a way to learn the circuits. So somebody like Lando Norris, you know, I first came across when he was 14 and first started racing in Ginetta Junior. In fact, I heard the name before that when he was karting. So seeing those people like little Lando, who was so painfully shy, and you know, seeing him blossom into now somebody who is, he's got the confidence for what was always there, which was a naughty, cheeky little personality, but you never got to see it because he was too painfully shy. And that now he's got that confidence, and that it's all coming out. So yeah, it's lovely that there's nobody, to go back to your original question, there's nobody I could say this is the moment that so-and-so arrived, because you hear about them before they ever get there.
But would you say there are stars and there are good drivers?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got to say Max Verstappen is an absolute star, isn't he? You know, I'm sure it can be a pain in the ass to work with at times. I mean, having said that, I've not done that many interviews with him because I'm not in the paddock that often these days, but I've had some lovely interviews with him. He's very respectful, and I think he's just a bit shy and sort of, you know, a bit protective at times. But so for sure, you know, he for me is the most exciting driver out there at the moment. And I'm just trying to think of some others that have, I mean, Alonso, you know, I remember when Alonso was making his debut. Is any driver who hustles his car higher up the grid than he should be? George Russell, you know, he's getting a massive respect at the moment because he's constantly hauling that Williams further up the grid than it should be. So, you know, those are the guys that, and it's not simple. They've still got to wait for a few, you know, the stars have got to align and, you know, fortune's got to go their way. And there's so much needs to fall into place for anybody to even get into Formula One, let alone, you know, rise to the top in Formula One. I'm sure there are some brilliant drivers who could have gone so much further in Formula One. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time or whatever it might be. But yeah. Did that answer your question? I can't remember what your original question was.
Neither can I, but I think it answered it more. So yeah, I'll take that.
I always reckon a question is just a prompter stream of
Okay. So if you could go to any country on any circuit with any motorsport, where would your top three places to go be? So, for example, I would go to Interlagos in Brazil with Formula One. That would be the best place for me to go. Where would your top three be?
I would go to... where would I go? Interlagos is fabulous. It'd be worth it. The atmosphere there. To be fair, I don't think the last couple of times I've been, because there haven't been that many South American drivers, it, you know, back in the day, there'd be whistles and God knows what, stomping and whistling going on from Krakatoa. Oh, that's a really tricky question. Because you see, I'd kind of like to go to the places that I haven't been. So I'd love to go, I love Australia. So I'd love to do Bathurst. I'd have to sneak my beers in beforehand now that they have a quota of what you can take in and all of that kind of stuff. But so I'd love to do Bathurst. I would love to go to Le Mans as a punter. I've worked at Le Mans. But, you know, Le Mans is, when you're working, is just bloody hard work and a lack of sleep. I'd like to have the lack of sleep because I'm on the big wheel. And I'm out around the circuit and I'm, you know, hooning around having fun. I'd love to experience that as a fan. And I'd quite like to go, and again, because I never have, and I'm not a massive fan of the States, but I've never been to a NASCAR race. And it would have to be like in the Carolinas or something like that, proper Oakie from the Skokie kind of, you know, good old homeboy kind of NASCAR. Just because I've never been to any of those. So they're kind of, I say I've been to Le Mans, but not as a punter. So... Those would probably be my three choices.
We were talking about Le Mans the other day with Sam Bird. So, Louise, if you want to go with someone, just give me a shout, because I'm absolutely dying to do the same thing. I've heard so many stories about how it is just a complete party, but full of real motorsport fans, you know, not your once-a-year motorsport fans. It's the hardcore fans. So, yeah, I'll see you there. Absolutely.
Trust me, it's full of people who've just gone along for the booze as well.
I'll definitely be there then.
Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. It all adds to the atmosphere.
So you've just got back from Bahrain, yes. You said before we started recording. So what was the atmosphere like out there? What are your sort of predictions? I'm going to leave this as quite an open question, but what are your predictions for this year, in F1 and F2 and the Junior Series?
It's the first time. I was down in Melbourne last year for the Grand Prix that never happened, and I haven't been along to one since. So it was my first time back in the sort of COVID secure paddock. So that was all really weird. It's so delineated and, you know, rightly so, about where you can go and having to stick to the corridor. I was paranoid about setting foot in the wrong place. You know, we even had like a guard on our lift at the hotel to make sure it was only F1 people using that lift. So they're very strict in their protocols. So I was a bit shit scared about getting something wrong there. And you know, you kind of want to go up and hug people, but it's all this kind of elbow bumping going on, which is... but you could... I just think that race... God, it's what we've all been waiting for, isn't it? You know, just more than one team battling... So it's what I think it's what I, listen, I'm sure I was going to say probably Mercedes, but you know what? I think even Mercedes would agree that the sport's got to be captivating. It's got to be engaging. It's got to be exciting, you know, and if you, there's no point turning on your television if you know who's going to win every weekend. So, and it's always been that way. You know, people are sort of kind of a hostage to their own success. They, Michael Schumacher and his Ferrari years, it was everybody was saying, oh, it's just dull. You know, well, you can't blame somebody for doing the right thing. But I think even just outside of that, even, as I say, Mercedes would celebrate the fact that it really looks now like we're going to have a proper battles going on. We'll go to a race and we won't know who's going to win. And we won't know. And if we just want all to see people scrapping, don't we? You know, you want to see teams going head to head. You want to see, I actually think there were quite a few exciting races last year, just because it was all a bit different and things were out of the normal order, and that's what everybody liked. People remember the races where things go wrong and where you know, where you do get surprise winners and you get the joy of results when people aren't expecting them, and it's the emotional side of it. That's what we all connect with as fans and as viewers. We want to experience the emotions, and you don't get terribly excited when it's the same person winning everything. I think even if you're, and it sounds a horrible thing to say, because, you know, Lewis Hamilton has been winning all the time because he's so bloody good and he's got such a good team. So you can't take away from the skill and, you know, what they're doing, but it's not much fun to watch, is it? So that for me was the overriding feeling, certainly with the guys that I was with. And I think around the paddock as a whole, it's like, yes, bring it on. This is going to be fun.
We all absolutely loved Bahrain. We just thought it was a really, really great start to the season. Hamilton won. But obviously there was a little bit of controversy with the track limits. What do you think about the track limits and Verstappen's overtake? I'd like to get actually someone who was there and get your opinion on it as a reporter.
To be honest, I can only get the same view as people obviously had, is that, you know, we were listening to Sky, and I kind of bow to Martin's superior knowledge there. And in fact, Sam Power, who I was with doing the Virtual Paddock Club TV stuff, and Sam is also a former racing driver, was saying the same thing. You know, the minute Verstappen let Lewis back pass, Sam said, wrong place to do it, wrong place. He's cost himself too much time there. He should have waited till he got around to the straight and let him pass there, because he could have got straight past him again. And so I think I'm sure that, you know, Red Bull are kicking themselves. I think, it was clearly over the track limits. So you're going to give the place back rather than have it taken back. But although, having said that, again, you know, Max's view would have been, I'll take the 5-second penalty because I can make that up on the road. So these decisions are just made in a split second. Was it the right decision? I must admit, I haven't delved into what's undoubtedly been all sorts of opinions coming out ever since to have a look about you know, what people thought, an analysis of it. But you've got to feel it was kind of a, it was a bit of an own goal for Red Bull. But hey, it's what happens.
So in 2021 as well, we're visiting new venues. Well, we're not, but everyone's visiting new venues that we haven't visited before, with Zandvoort, Saudi Arabia later in the season. Is there one that you're particularly excited for that you think will provide an action-packed race?
I think Zandvoort will be amazing. It's not a circuit I've ever been to, but I've heard lots of good stories about, you know, Zandvoort races back in the day. The Dutch fans are mad in a nice way, you know, so there'll be so much atmosphere there. And I don't know much about the circuit, but, you know, it's going to be another, you know, the wind's blowing in the wrong direction. You've got sand everywhere. And, you know, I just think that will be, I love the atmosphere of a race. You know, people wax lyrical about this circuit and that circuit. I just think, I'm not driving around it. I don't care if Eau Rouge is the best corner. You know, I'm not driving around it. What I want is the atmosphere of a Sao Paulo, or, you know, the atmosphere of a Monza. That's the bit that kind of gets me excited when I'm at circuit, rather than the specific layout of the track. Yes, it's got to be a layout that engenders a good race rather than somewhere that nobody can overtake. So, I think Zandvoort would be, I don't know whether I'll be going to that one, but it would be great if I am. I've kind of got to fit my F1 commitments in alongside British Touring Car Championship, which is obviously my kind of main gig for ITV these days. So I've only got through as far as Silverstone. I haven't looked past that yet to see which of the Grand Prix that I'll be doing. But yeah, Zandvoort would for sure be way up there.
We've seen how crazy and involved the Dutch fans are at places like Austria and Germany, let alone in their home country, with Max racing in his home country. I think it'll be mad.
I know I was in Austria for Channel 4 a few years ago, and one of the things I had to do was go out and film amongst, so there was like a grandstand, like the orange grandstand. And it was sometimes like when you go out there sort of filming the bits with the, you know, with the punters, it's kind of not, I get a bit embarrassed. I'm not a kind of cheerleader. I can't do the, yeah, give us a, you know what I mean? I get, trust me, you didn't need to out there. You just turned up with a camera and they were all like, yay, behind the camera. And so, they're fun. They like their racing. They know they're racing. And there's a lovely heritage of racing there as well. I think that, again, makes a difference for me. You go to some of the new places where there's no history and there's no heritage, and people come along for the first year for the novelty value. And then after that, you know, you don't get many people coming along, and it loses its atmosphere. Whereas places like said, they'll be so excited to see Formula One back there.
Mm. It's the VIPs versus the motorsport fans, isn't it? And what you've just said about the Max fans, I remember I was at Silverstone, and I can't remember what year it was, but Max overtook someone, and there were just a huge bunch of Max fans there, and they let off a load of what do you call them, poppers and all this, and I ended up cheering
that
with
was
them.
Me.
Oh yeah, it was probably Callum, but it's people that just love motorsport, no matter who it is, and you don't get that.
That's one thing that I've been lucky enough to go round on the truck for the drivers' parade at a few different circuits, but I can remember going round on the truck at Silverstone a few years back, and it was one of those kind of take your breath, proud to be British moments, because they were cheering for everybody. And okay, maybe partly we've got a lot of different nationalities that live in this country, but just speaking to drivers about it, they will say, you know, even foreign drivers will have a lot of respect for the Silverstone crowd, because they say they're passionate about motorsport first and foremost. So yes, they'll be partisan. Obviously, you're going to have more Lewis fans at the British Grand Prix than you are somewhere else. I think that the British audience, same when you go to Japan, you know, they're just passionate about their motorsport, and they know their motorsport. So it's, yeah, it made me very proud that, because you go some other places and they're booing the foreign, and I hate that kind of stuff. It really, I just hate booing full stop. So I love the fact that the British audience, yes, it may favour Lewis, but it has a lot of respect for everybody out there on the track, and every single driver, you know, he's got somebody cheering for them. There's banners for everybody. It's not just a sea of red like you get in Monza or anything like that.
Just before we wrap up, because I can see Ollie's just anxious to wrap things up, I've got one last question for you.
He's the rapper-upper, is he?
He's the rapper-upper. He's the host. One last question. Yeah. I want you to predict.
Oh.
Give me your prediction. And bear in mind, if you pass this, I'm taking away the motorsport time machine and you can't go and see James Hunt in the 70s.
That's so mean.
Red Bull or Mercedes, who's winning this year?
You know, the only reason I Can I just say why I hesitate? Because we used to have a sweepstake at ITV. How long was I with ITV? 10 years? I never once won the bloody thing. Because I always go with my heart rather than with my head.
Go with your heart, that's fine. My heart's with Red Bull. So Red I'm Bull. Saying Red Bull.
I'm saying Red Bull.
Yes. Ooh. That's fine, correct answer. You keep the time.
I love the Red Bull guys. I've hung out with, bear in mind, Adrian Newey and I came into Formula One at the same time. You know, we go back a long way. So, and I've just hung out with those guys a lot more. I know those guys a lot more. So, yeah, Red Bull. Red Bull every time.
Yeah, see, Emma said I'm going to cry, but actually, I'm a Mercedes fan, but I think I would rather Red Bull won it. I really do, because we need a bit of spice in the sport again. But Louise, we are running out of time. Do you just want to tell us what you're doing at the moment then, outside of motorsport?
That's my cue to talk about my media training, is it? Well, yeah, so that's my little... When ITV pulled out of covering Formula One, I kind of thought, first thought was, shit, I've got no job. But then I thought, well, actually, I kind of always had in the back of my mind that I needed to have another string to my bow. So I set up a little media training company. And I know people, a lot of people think, oh, you don't want media training because it just makes them boring and bland. But that's not the way I work. It's about giving people an understanding of how the media works so that then they go into the media environment more in control and able to get something out. Bottom line and top line is personalities. We need personalities. But people are going to be, racing drivers are control freaks. So if you put them into an environment where they don't feel in control, they're not going to perform at their best. So it's about letting them know how everything works. And that's kind of, it started out in racing, very niche, but it's kind of broadened out beyond that. So I'm working with all sorts of different, you know, business people and different sports people and anybody who's either got to stand up, anybody who's got to hold a microphone, be it, you know, or speak into a microphone, be it give an interview or hosting an interview or, you know, appearing on stage somewhere or making a presentation in a boardroom. That's what I do.
So Louise, how have we done out of 10 then?
Oh, don't, that's 10 out of 12 out of 10.
Yeah, I had to ask that.
Genuinely though, and this is going to sound really horrible, but I hadn't come across you guys until you contacted me. So, of course, the first thing I did was Google you. I was super impressed.
Thank you. That does mean a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, you personally. I meant the website, you know.
Oh, sorry.
Time machine's gone.
No, and again, we are just a bunch of people that love motorsport, and it doesn't have to be F1. We watch all of it. Louise, thank you so much
for
joining us. And go and get a glass of wine or whatever you want to do on your bank holiday. If you would, you know, later on in the year, we'd love to speak to you again. But thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome. Have a lovely Easter, everybody, and meet you again in your case, Emma.
Yes.
Good luck with it all.
Cheers, thank you. And if you aren't already, subscribe to our podcast. Hit that subscribe button, 5-star rating. Let us know what you thought in the comments as well. It really helps out. Dan, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Callum, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Jesus Christ. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And tell you what, Louise loved the time machine, didn't she? You love that.
I think this is going to be the most regular feature on our interviews.
Yeah, everyone's going in the time machine now. Everyone. Yeah,
everyone. We need to keep a list of where people go in the time machine as well and then write an awesome article about it. And Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you. And I hope everybody enjoys their Easter and has lots of chocolate eggs. Can't wait.
Yes, not bacon eggs, but we will see you next week. Goodbye.